Coming to you across the ether at the speed of light, it's the Mortgage Moment with Mark Wells and Carrie Deese of Preferred Financial Services. Join us for the next hour. We're going to increase your mortgage IQ. Carrie, clients almost invariably walk into my office, and the first thing they do is they apologize for having so many questions to ask when they sit down for the first time to discuss a mortgage. And one thing I always tell them is that if I had to walk into their workplace today and perform their job, I'd have to ask a million questions to them. Yeah.
And it doesn't matter what kind of job it is.
No.
You know?
And every business has its own vocabulary. Every business has its own terms. And the mortgage industry probably has more than its fair share of both of those two things. And then you add to that, a mortgage transaction is something you don't do every day. In fact, most people may not do more than one or two of these in a lifetime. So all of that adds up to the need for information and the need to be well-informed. And I would say if you ever sit across from a loan officer who resents your questions, you should probably get up and get out.
Yeah.
Because you should have questions about this big a financial transaction. What we want to do this morning, though, is kind of step you through beginning to end of what you might expect to encounter in the loan process itself. If you decide today, hey, it's time for us to buy a house, we want to take you from that point all the way to closing, share with you some of the terms and vocabulary that you're going to come across, share with you some of the things you'll need to be prepared to do and things you'll need to be prepared to not do, and just help you to become familiar, increase your mortgage IQ. So let's start at the starting point. Carrie, where do we begin the saga? If you decide you're going to buy a house, what's the first thing we want to do?
Well, you want to call us and get a pre-qualification.
Okay, and let's talk about what a pre-qualification is and is not. A pre-qualification, if done correctly, includes all of your personal information. That means your name, Social Security number, date of birth, where you live, where you work, how long you've worked there, how much money you make. The type of information that a lender is going to use eventually to approve your loan. A pre-qualification, though, is not a final loan approval. Now, we at Preferred Financial Services, we use all of the automated underwriting systems once we have all this information compiled and we have a borrower's credit report. We can run any purchase scenario through Fannie Mae's automated underwriting system, Freddie Mac's, FHA's, VA's, USDA's. And the great thing about that is that kind of puts a borrower, what I call 95% across the line. It's very rare, although a human underwriter may choose to overturn the automated underwriting decision in our day and time, it just rarely happens. So we can't tell you at a pre-qualification stage what you're guaranteed a loan. And no one can. And by the way, don't let anybody tell you that. There's some national lenders that advertise and will, you know, give you a loan approval in 8 minutes. Well, they're giving you a pre-approval, a pre-qualification. There's a lot more in the loan process and a lot more that goes into it before you have an actual loan approval. But here at Preferred Financial, we can do exactly that. It doesn't take 8 to 10 minutes to do. It will be a pre-qualification that will let you know how much house you can buy. It will help you identify how much your monthly payment would be for the maximum amount of house you can afford. If you think that payment's too high, you can say, well, look, I don't want my payment to exceed X number of dollars, and we can back that down to a price range that you need to go shop in order to qualify. So the pre-qualification determines how much house you may be able to afford, although it doesn't tell you you have to go out and buy that much house if you don't want to. It also helps identify the types of programs that will be available to you. Why is that important, Carrie? Why do people need to know what different programs they might qualify for?
Well, you know, different programs have different rates. They have different requirements for how much you have to put down and where those funds can come from.
Yeah, a lot of variables there. So the more information we get from you, the more we're able to steer you towards the programs that will work best for you. And sometimes just to give you the choices of programs. Our pre-qualification also includes a three-bureau credit report that has your FICO scores. And I want to mention that many consumer credit monitoring sites, although they purport to give you your credit scores, if you dig down into the fine print, what you're seeing is what's known as a Vantage score or a Plus score, and it's not an actual FICO. And unfortunately, the pluses and Vantage scores don't always correlate to your FICO. We can find sometimes 20 to 40 point differences. Usually the Vantage and Plus scores are higher than the FICO, so sometimes we're a little bit the bearer of a bad tiding that your scores aren't quite where they should be. But at the same time, with our pre-qualification, we always show you how between now and when you purchase a home, you can improve those scores. Because the higher you get the scores, the better rate you're going to get. Even if you're qualified to buy where you are with the scores you have right now, if you get your scores higher, you stand a chance of getting a better rate, lower PMI premiums, even lower homeowner insurance premiums. So we'll always show you with your pre-qual some little tweaks you might be able to do to your credit in order to enhance your scores before you buy. Remember, as we said, a pre-qualification is not a loan approval, but with an automated underwriting, it can give you about a 95% certainty that everything is going to be okay. When we complete a pre-qualification, what we like to give you is a letter that is a pre-approval letter, pre-qualification letter, and it states the amount of house you are qualified to buy. Now, we recommend that you use these letters only if you're engaging a realtor. This is not a letter that's going to go to your seller that you're going to make an offer for. Because, for instance, we may have done a letter for you saying you qualify to buy a $250,000 house, and you may not want to go that high. So maybe you're going to put an offer on a $200,000 house. Well, you don't really want your seller to know you're qualified to $250,000 because then they just think, well, we can just charge more for this house. So we will provide a second letter after that when you get ready to make an actual offer, in which we put the address of the home that you're making the offer on. We put the exact purchase price that you're going to go in and offer and the exact amount of down payment you're going to make. And we tailor your pre-qualification letter for your contract offer. The initial one is just for realtor eyes only. Realtors will want to know that you're pre-qualified before they spend 4 or 5 weeks showing you 100 different properties only to find out you couldn't buy one. So they will want that letter in the beginning, but we'll do a more specific one later. Carrie, let's talk about some terms that may come across the horizon when we talk about pre-qualification. What are some of the terms our new buyers might find?
Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, who are the heavy hitters, the clearing houses for conventional loans.
That's right. If we talk about a conforming or a conventional loan, eventually those loans are funded by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So you'll hear the term Fannie Freddie. You'll hear the term conventional or conforming, and that's what we're talking about, that type of loan. What other terms, Carrie?
There's FHA, which is a government-insured loan.
That's correct. Not a government-issued loan, but a government-insured loan. FHA is Federal Housing Authority, and they insure the loan against default so that the lender will allow you to buy with a very minor down payment, 3.5% on FHA. What are some other terms?
VA for qualified veterans.
Okay, and that reminds me that if you are pre-qualifying with anyone, make certain that they know you're a veteran. About 99 times out of 100, if you're a veteran, the VA loan is going to be the best program for you, and there's no way we can know that you're qualified for that unless you identify yourself as a veteran. We can check your eligibility for you. We can make sure that you're eligible to use the program, and usually that's your best option. And one last one, Carrie, USDA. What's a USDA loan?
It is for homes in federally designated areas that could qualify for 100% financing.
And those are rural areas, and they're established by the federal government, by the Department of Agriculture, which is where the loan gets its name. When we get back, we're going to talk about once you're pre-qualified, where do you go from there? We'll increase your mortgage IQ, so hang in there with us. See you after the break.
Welcome back, everybody. Thank you for joining us this morning. We are working on increasing your mortgage IQ. So if you have questions, call us Monday through Friday at 864-235-9596. You can email us at themortgagemoment@gmail.com. And you can catch all of our past shows at preferredfinancialgreenville.com.
Thanks, Carrie. Increasing people's mortgage IQ, just helping you to be familiar with what the loan process will be. If you weren't with us when we first started, it's often an intimidating process to begin to look at buying a house. And we want to take all of that intimidation factor away by just educating you a little bit, giving you some terms so that you know what they mean, and just helping you understand what you will go through as you begin your mortgage phase. So we talked about before the break that your starting point before you ever go out to look at a house is to get pre-qualified. That pre-qualification should include a three-bureau credit report and an automated underwriting. Remember that no matter what the person on the other end of the phone says, a preliminary approval or a pre-qualification is not a final loan approval. There are multitudes of factors that go into a final loan approval. But if the information given to us is accurate, your pre-approval, that puts you about 95% across the line ready to buy. So once you've gone through a pre-approval, and once you have gone out looking at homes and you have found a home that you want to put an offer on, and you make that offer, we will, when you make the offer, we'll do a specific letter to go in with your offer that tells the seller that you are qualified to buy that particular house at this particular price with this much down payment. And that's going to give the seller a lot of comfort in negotiating with you because they know that you're able to purchase the home. They're not going to draw blanks 3 weeks down the road and find out you couldn't buy the house. But once you have the contract on the house, you're really ready to start into the meat of your mortgage process. And one of the first things you want to do at this point is get a rate quote. Now, there are many different ways in which lenders might quote you rates. The one that I find, I think, the easiest for everyone to compare one with the other is to use what is known as a fee sheet. A fee sheet is not an official document in a loan file. It doesn't have a signature page, but it's a page on which your mortgage broker, your mortgage lender can show you what rate they are quoting, what payment that rate will result in, what the closing costs of the loan are. And the thing I like about the fee sheet is that it itemizes every single closing cost that you'll encounter. And it's a good touchstone. When you get ready to formally apply, you go back to that sheet and say, well, wait a minute, here's what you quoted me for a tax service fee, and now you're quoting me something different. And you either get a reasonable explanation or you move on to the next lender who was honest with you to begin with. So you're ready for a rate quote. We suggest you get a fee sheet that breaks down all the closing costs. And let's talk about some of the items that you're going to encounter on your fee sheet. So, again, you're familiar with some of the vocabulary and the terms. There are going to be at the top of the fee sheet some items that relate to what are known as origination charges. Carrie, what are considered origination charges in a loan?
An origination fee, any discount points, any underwriting or admin fees, and any processing fees.
Okay, so touchstone words there are origination fees. Now, in our listening area, typically when a borrower asks what's your current interest rate, they are assuming that you are going to answer them by quoting a rate that has a 1% origination fee but has no discount points because discount points can artificially buy the rate down. And it's important when you're getting your fee sheets to make sure that you put everyone on an apples-to-apples basis. So you might tell your broker or your lender that you're talking to, please quote me your rate with a 1% origination fee and no discount points. But included in origination charges can be some of the other things that Carrie mentioned. Underwriting fees, which lenders have. Sometimes they call those administrative fees or admin fees. And sometimes, Carrie, what did you say, processing fees?
Processing fees. You might also see commitment fee.
Commitment fee, those type things. These are all part of your origination charges, and you need to compare every broker, every lender's origination charges to the next one so you get an accurate feel for who's quoting you the best terms. Now, to also put everyone on an apples-to-apples basis, realize that some of the items on the fee sheet can only be estimates. What are the items, Carrie, that typically in the beginning of the process, we have no idea what they really are, but from our experience, we will offer an estimate of what those costs might be?
Any attorney-related fees, because they may differ a little bit from attorney to attorney.
All right.
Your tax and insurance.
Tax and property taxes and homeowners insurance.
Right.
Yes,
right.
Absolutely. So what is best to do, I think, is when you, if you're going to get multiple quotes, then tell each lender, each broker, what you are using for insurance. That can be, you can get that estimate from the first one you talk to and then use that for all the rest of them. Do the same thing for property taxes. And that way everybody's estimates are the same, because those items will be what they will be independent of who's quoting you a rate. The important fees to look at really are the origination charges. That's where the lenders and brokers will differ in what they're quoting to you. So on this fee sheet that you get, you're going to see origination charges. You're also going to see something called a tax service fee. And everybody wonders, what in the world is that thing? Well, there are two instances under which your property taxes will be paid. You will either escrow a monthly amount with your house payment that the lender will accumulate in an escrow account and pay your taxes for you at the end of the year. Or if you put 20% down on a loan, you don't have to escrow if you don't want to. However, the lender at the end of each calendar year will require the county to report to them that you paid your property taxes. So the tax service fee is charged by the county of origin to do one of two things, either to send your property tax bill to the lender to be paid if you're escrowing, or to send notification to your lender that you paid your property taxes, because property taxes can take precedence over a mortgage, and the lender's not going to let delinquent taxes pile up, because the county could foreclose on your house and the lender could lose money. So that's what a tax service fee is. We have a flood certification fee. What is that, Carrie?
Every lender is going to pull a flood cert to make sure that your home is not in a flood zone.
And where do they get those flood certs from?
Directly from FEMA.
FEMA. We've heard about them.
That's another one of those acronyms.
That's right. But FEMA, in this case, I've never had a problem with the flood certification. Have you? Do you remember?
Mm-mm.
Yeah. Of all the government things that seem to fall apart all the time, getting flood certs is no problem. Great news about a flood certification is that with a flood certification that shows that your property is not in a federal flood zone, you do not necessarily have to have a survey of your property. Now, when I got into business 30 years ago, every time we closed a loan, whether that was a refinance or whether it was a purchase, we had to get a survey. And those things cost, well, probably now they're more like $600, but back then they were $350 to $450. And we had to have one every single time. So the satellite mapping of the United States has alleviated a lot of the need for surveys, because everything in the U.S. has been surveyed from a satellite perspective, and that's all recorded now. But if you are in a flood zone, you may need a survey to show whether or not your house itself is up out of the flood zone. And what do they call that, Carrie, if you can show the type of survey you get to show that your house is, if your property touches a flood zone, that your house is not in the flood zone?
That is either an elevation survey or an elevation certificate.
That's right. You get one or the other, and that exempts you from having to purchase flood insurance. Now, upstate, there are not many flood zones. We ran into one, though, just in the last week or two, didn't we?
We did, and that client talked to FEMA, and they think he might be a good candidate to get what's called a letter of map amendment that will amend the flood map to show that as not in that flood zone.
Right. So there are some remedies. The good news in the upstate and in our listening region, North Carolina, is the building codes prevent anybody from building in a flood zone. You cannot build in a floodplain, 100-year floodplain. However, occasionally rivers change course. If you have a big flood, it can change the direction and course of a river and change the floodplain. So sometimes a house that was built near a creek or river that was not in a flood zone may one day turn up in a flood zone because of that. But your flood certification fee is only like $12. What, $12, $15
yeah,
bucks is cheap. But that's what that does. Then we've got attorney-related fees. And, Carrie, these get broken into all these categories, and you look at them and your eyes glaze over. So what would you expect in specific charges that we would call altogether attorney fees?
I would just call them attorney and title-related charges.
And specifically, what are some of the ways in which attorneys might itemize those charges?
There's the attorney fee or settlement fee itself. It's what you're paying them to close your loan.
That's usually just for the attorney to do the work.
Right. Uh-huh. Usually between $375 and $475.
Okay.
There's your title search, mm-hmm. Your title binder.
Okay. Let's talk about a minute. There's a title search. What does that do for a person?
That is actually when they go and look at everything that's been recorded on the property previously to make sure that everything was done accurately and that the ownership is what it's reported to be.
Correct. So that you get a clear title mm-hmm. to the property and not a clouded title. So your title search is critical, and that's one of the charges that the attorney has. Your title binder effectively is a certificate that says to the lender, we are going to bind title insurance coverage for this property so that it can close, because your title insurance policy does not activate until the day you close. So the binder lets the insurance, lets the lender know that the home will be issued a title insurance policy. That's required to have a lender's title insurance policy. What does title insurance do, Carrie?
Title insurance protects you in case something is missed and maybe there was a lien on the property, and in those cases, the lien follows the property instead of the person.
Yeah, that's something that's not often well known. But for instance, if your seller had a judgment mm-hmm. in a civil court and the judgment was recorded, it's recorded as a lien on your property. And if your attorney that's handling your transaction for you to buy that house happens to miss that, well, all of a sudden you inherited your seller's lien. Because the lien is against the property. It's also against the seller, but it's against the property. So title insurance protects you from that. It also protects you from flaws in the title that may have occurred from names signed in the wrong place, failure to sign in the right place. There are a lot of things that can cloud title, and your title insurance protects you in the event that there's any flaws in the title. When we get back, we'll finish with the few items that you could expect to have on your loan estimate sheet. We'll increase your IQ. So grab that second cup of coffee and join us after the break. Talking this morning about the entire mortgage process, start to finish, so that as you contemplate buying a house, you can kind of become educated in what you're going to experience along the way, giving you some insight into what some of the terms might mean. If you missed the first part of our show, you can catch this entire show on our website, preferredfinancialgreenville.com. Or if you just have a question because you might have missed something that we've covered, or something we're not covering, please pick up the phone, 864-235-9596. We're there 9 to 5 every day, really 8 to 5. I'm there even earlier than that.
Really, 6:30 to 5.
Yeah, 6:30 to 5, but I don't answer the phone until about 8 o'clock. So we're talking about items that you will see on your fee sheet once you're under contract and you're getting some quotes together. Now, we talked about putting every lender that you get a quote from on an apples-to-apples basis. So you want to tell each broker or each lender that you're getting a quote from how you want the loan quoted. We suggest you tell them, I would like your interest rate with a 1% origination fee, no discount points. You can always talk about buying a rate down later. And then you want to tell each lender or broker what number to use for property taxes for the house you're buying and for insurance. If you don't know what those would be, ask the first guy what he's estimating those to be, and then give those numbers to everybody else. That way you get a good apples-to-apples comparison. You can see who has the best rate and the best terms. Now, some items that you're going to see on your fee sheet that you may not know what these really are. One of the confusing terms that I find, Carrie, is that whenever a borrower asks me, what are my closing costs going to be? What they mean is, what is this sucker going to cost me top to bottom, okay? And they usually even sometimes that mean down payment and closing costs. But usually when they say closing costs, they mean loan-related charges. Mm-hmm. But there's a legal distinction within all of the costs to close a mortgage. And that distinction is some of those things are legally termed closing costs. But then other items are legally called prepaid items. But prepaid items in our minds are normally part of what we would consider closing costs in general.
Mm-hmm.
So when we itemize prepaids, what are the specific items that are legally defined as prepaid items?
Think of it as anything that you are prepaying for the loan. So your prepaid interim interest, we'll explain more about that in a moment. Your homeowner's insurance that you're paying for the next year, and your escrow account that you are setting up.
Okay. So prepaids consist of those four things. Escrow accounts are money that your lender holds to pay bills that you owe. So, for instance, they collect a monthly amount of homeowner's insurance premium and a monthly amount of property tax, and then they pay those bills when they come to you. So escrow charges, and when you start your loan, you have to start your escrow account in the beginning. And the funds that go into the escrow account are part of what are legally defined as prepaid. Now, I will mention this, that it used to be, and this is many, many years ago, that a seller could not pay your prepaids. They could only pay the closing costs. That's no longer true and hasn't been true for probably 15, almost 20 years. So when we say closing costs in general, yes, the seller can pay them all. When we legally define them as closing costs and prepaids, seller can pay both, but you need to know the difference. So interim interest is another very confusing item that I find when we try to explain what it is. When you take out a mortgage, the mortgage begins to amortize, meaning you begin to make a payment. So there's always, there would be the legitimate question, when I make my payment on September 1st, what am I really paying? Am I paying for the interest that will accrue for the next month? Or am I paying for the interest that already accrued last month? And what about my principal payment? So here's how it's legally set up, and this is true across every single mortgage program that we mention. Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, VA, FHA, USDA, all, jumbo, all loans, all mortgage loans, when you make your payment on the first of the month, you are technically paying the previous month's interest and the current month's principal. It's just how they're legally set up. When you buy a house, you may close on the 25th day of the month. Well, if you do, you take the number of days left in the month, 6 days if it's August, and you, at closing, pay that 6 days' worth of interest. You pay it at closing. And you say, well, golly, I'm going to close on the 31st then I don't have to pay any. Well, that's right. But here's what happens. Let's take the two extremes. Let's say you close a loan on the 31st of the month, August 31st. You pay the interim interest. There's none because it's the last day of the month. But when is your first payment under that scenario, Carrie?
Your first payment is going to be October 1st.
So it's going to be 30 days from then. You won't have a September payment. You don't have one the next day. You closed on the 31st. You do not have a payment the next day, but you will have a payment the 1st of October. Let's say you miss that closing date and you go 1 day over. Now, all of a sudden, you've got to pay 30 days of interim interest instead of none. And that sounds terrible. And everybody panics and says, what in the world? We've got to close the last day of the month. Well, what does it mean about their first payment if they skip to the next day, Carrie?
It gets fast-forwarded to the next month, so November 1st.
Absolutely. That's right. So it's six and one half dozen of the other folks. All this clamor to close your loan on the last day of the month is just a bit overblown. Technically, you bring a little more money to closing when you close early in the month. However, you have a lot longer to the first payment that you make.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, it all washes out. So don't worry so much about when you close. Set your contract closing when it suits you to move, and don't worry so much about interim interest. Now, let's talk about some things that the fee sheet does not include. And if you're going to be increasing your mortgage IQ, you need to be aware that there are going to be some non-loan related costs in buying your home. But your fee sheet is only going to show you costs associated directly with the loan. Carrie, what are some of the things that can come up that are going to be potential expenses that a borrower needs to budget for, but they may not show up on a lender's fee sheet?
A big one is inspections. Could be your home inspection, which is not the same as the appraisal. pest inspection,
yeah.
Radon
yeah.
inspections. Sometimes we mm-hmm. see those.
Yep.
And various other inspections that you might want to have done.
And the reason they don't show up is they're optional.
Right.
You don't have to have a home inspection to close a loan. I do have people ask me that from time to time. You do not have to have it, so it's not going to be on your fee sheet, but you may want it. So you may want to budget for it. What are the things, Kerry, can show up other than inspections?
One of the biggest ones is HOA dues,
yeah.
Homeowners Association. So not only do you often have to pay the first month up front, sometimes there are capital contribution fees, HOA transfer fees, and this stuff, depending on the price of your home, can add up to, you know.
Several hundred dollars.
Yeah.
They really can. Cheap. Yeah, it's not. Now, you need to get these costs from your realtor.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever a property is listed, it will tell the realtor whether there are HOA dues. It will tell them how much they are, whether they're paid in advance, in arrears, or how they will come out. But your realtor is the source to go to for your non-loan-related charges that you may need to budget for because they're not going to be on your fee sheet.
And we're happy to add them to the fee sheet for you.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
you know what they are, we'll put them on there.
You just need to know what they are.
Because one of the things the borrower always wants to know is, okay, what's my bottom line?
Mm-hmm.
How much money do I need to bring to closing? And unfortunately, that's not a quick answer. We don't always get the final numbers until a few days before closing, but we can put you close. We can put you within a few hundred dollars ballpark in the very beginning. Once we tie down exactly what taxes are going to be and exactly what insurance is going to be and exactly what day you're closing, okay, we can get down to the penny. But in the beginning, some of these things are going to be estimates. That's why your initial fee sheet that you'll get with your actual loan package is going to be called a loan estimate, L-E. It is still has estimated items and is not your final numbers. So let's say you've gotten the quotes. You've got them all spread out. You got your spreadsheet. Now it's time to choose who you're going to work with. Let me make a suggestion here. Rate is not everything and cost is not everything. I would recommend that one of the elements of your choice be the personality of the person and company you're dealing with to make sure it suits your personality. You're going to be in a 30 to 45 day relationship with your lender or broker. And the most important component of that is trust. The most important component of that is that you get along, because there are going to be some tense times. There are going to be some times when you're going to be asked to provide documentation. You're not going to like the reason they need it, but you're going to have to do it anyway. There are going to be times where property difficulties come up. You need someone on the other end who's going to help you, not ratchet up your anxiety. You're going to need to have a partner who will work with you. What I love about our broker platform, Kerry, is that we legally, ethically, in every way, we represent the borrower's interest. It lets us help you. It makes us establish this relationship, but it still has to be a good match.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I wouldn't kid anybody. We're probably not the perfect match for everybody out there, only 99.9% of them, right? But choose your mortgage broker according to personality and whether you get along. You're going to be in this together. You need to get along, and you need to know you've got a partner with you in the deal.
And, you know, nobody can promise a perfect process. What we can promise is that we will communicate with you. We will be up front with you, and we will set the best expectations we can.
That's always critical. Thanks, Kerry. After you've chosen a mortgage broker, you're going to actually start your loan process. So we're going to go through what that's going to look like in our last segment. Join us after the break, and we'll finish up. We'll have you completely educated by the time we finish. So if we're increasing everybody's mortgage IQ, I guess we're kind of like college here. And we're divided into four segments. So we've already gotten our freshman information courses out of the way. Our sophomore and junior courses, we're now in our senior year. Does that sound good? All right, guys, you're about to graduate. We're talking about having chosen a mortgage broker. Where do you go from here? Well, your mortgage broker is going to, and this is critical, write this down, underline it, lock your rate in. I cannot tell you how quickly rates can rise and how slow they are to come back down.
Yep.
I do not recommend floating a rate. If your broker or lender insists on floating the rate, tell them thank you, but no thank you, and go to someone who will. Locks are free. They don't cost you anything. You can get up to a 60-day lock. Your best pricing will be with a 30 to 45-day lock. Your lock always needs to be good through the day you expect to close. And you need to know what the broker or lender's extension policy is, because when things come up, you can miss a deadline. You don't want to lose your rate. Most every lender that I know of has an extension policy. If they don't, say no thank you and go somewhere else. You're going to need the protection in a volatile rate market of your rate lock. The rate lock should be confirmed to you in writing so you know that the rate you've been quoted is locked in and good for you. Once your broker has done that, he'll generate the electronic disclosures that you don't have to physically sign, but you'll have to e-sign. And the e-sign process is really easy. Eventually, we're going to probably go to complete, we don't need any physically signed documents. And in fact, some lenders are really there, but our state regulations kind of want us to keep some hard signature copies in the file. So we still have a few things you'll hard sign, but increasingly we're going to electronic disclosures. One of those disclosures will be your LE, that is your loan estimate. It is the most important document you will look at. It's going to outline your rate, your estimated payment, your fees, how much you'll bring to closing. But you need to keep in mind at the front end, it's only an estimate. Now, the fees cannot change, Carrie, right?
Some of the fees can change.
Okay. The broker fees or the lender fees, the origination charges, cannot change unless there is a material change in circumstances, meaning house didn't appraise for what you thought it was and it changed your loan to value or something significant. And then you right. have to be redisclosed with the reason and accept the reason before anything can be changed. So your LE is going to lock in many of the fees, but then there's some numbers still, as we mentioned, property taxes and insurance, interim interest, that are still going to be estimates for a while. So this will get you close in the ballpark, but won't get you to exact numbers. And then your broker is going to generate your actual loan package. That's going to have your application form. It's going to have a lot of other forms that explain a lot about the loan, the process, the anti-discrimination laws. Some of those will be authorizations, so your employment can be checked and your income can be checked and your assets can be checked. Your broker will have any documents that you need to hard sign. Good thing about that is you don't necessarily have to come down and hand us an ink signed copy. You can do all this from home if you want to. You can print these things at home, sign them, scan them back to us. Or if you prefer to sit down face to face, which we really like to do, we welcome that. You can bring the loan package back in. We can sit down, go over any questions you have, and let you sign document by document. I'm going to turn this part of the show over to Carrie because she's the expert on this. With your loan package, you are going to need documentation. And I would say if one saying sums up documentation, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. If we get the documents right in the beginning, you will have a much easier time in underwriting. Don't you think so, Carrie?
Absolutely.
Worst thing is to generate a question, because a question leads to two more questions. Those two questions lead to four, and it's like it just multiplies on you.
Yep.
So, Carrie, talk to our borrowers about just what they need to compile and how they need to compile it for you.
Now, I'm going to start by saying some lenders are going to say, you know, they can underwrite your loan without getting any docs from you. They can take care of verifying all your bank statements, all of your income. You don't have to provide any of that documentation. Well, while that is technically true, it can also cause a lot of problems. Sometimes they can't get the documentation from your employer or your bank accounts. Sometimes things come up that they didn't know about and we didn't know about. It's a lot harder to fix the problem if we didn't know about it in the first place.
And let me say one thing about that one, Carrie. That sure. Deposits, for instance.
Absolutely.
Yeah, they can't get your bank statement. But what if there's a deposit in there that isn't sourced, and all of a sudden we find out there's a source that's not legitimate? We pick that up in the beginning before yep. it ever becomes an issue, and we deal with it. You don't want the lender just finding that.
Absolutely. So here's what we ask for. Your last 2 years' tax returns and W-2s, your last 2 months of bank statements on all of the accounts and any retirement accounts that you might have, the most recent full 30 days of pay stubs, a copy of your purchase contract for the home you're buying. If you're selling a home at the same time, we'll ask for that contract as well. And just be as thorough as possible. I may not send everything up to the lender, but I'm going to underwrite that loan first and try to address any problems up front so they don't have any reason to turn your loan down.
Yeah, one of the great things about the broker platform, again, is because we're the borrower's advocate. If a document comes across our desk that raises a bunch of issues, and we've got other documents that are sufficient, for instance, just for closing funds. If there's an account that has a bunch of deposits that need to be traced and sourced and pinned down and all that, and we don't need them, we don't just don't even send it up.
Right.
And it saves you a lot of headache and a lot of hassle. I will say that the single biggest thing that we don't get when we ask for documents is every page of every document.
Yes.
And that is critical. We have to have page 7 of 7, even if page 7 is totally blank. And why is that? Well, because the lender only knows what they see. And if it says page 6 of 7 and 7 is not there, they don't know this blank. So we have to have all pages of all documents whenever we're getting these. Now, once your loan is underway, Carrie, let's kind of give our buyers a feel for how long everything takes, okay? So from the time we've got a signed application and they've given you the documents that you need, what's our first milestone? How long do we go before really they can expect anything?
It's typically a week to 10 days on the long end,
okay,
before the initial underwriting is complete.
Okay, and let's talk about what underwriting is. That's a term you and I throw around, may just assume everybody knows what it is. What is the underwriting?
That is when the underwriter looks at your file, they calculate your income, they review your pay stubs, they look at your assets, and they enter all the data into the systems and make sure that you qualify for what we say that you qualify for.
So the underwriters are the big bad people up there in the ivory towers who decide whether they're going to give you a loan or not.
Right.
Yeah, they're the power people, and they're the ones that, you know, your fate is in their hands. But with us, you've got an advocate with them. So we wrestle with underwriters, and we win quite a lot, actually.
We do. You know, sometimes they ask us for stuff that we really don't need. And
we push back.
Pull up the guidelines and say, here's why you don't need it.
Yeah, where are you reading from? Yeah. Hey, and look, there's only like 484 pages of guidelines, so it's, you know.
484, try 1,200.
Is it 1,200?
1,200
pages.
Just one program, yeah.
Yeah, so Carrie has memorized every page.
Every page, oh,
yeah,
absolutely.
So she just backs underwriters back in a hole.
And the guidelines never, ever change.
They never change either. They're all the same. And they don't differ program to program. So you're 1,200 pages for Fannie, 1,200 for Freddie, 1,200 for VA, probably 1,000 million for VA. All right, after your loan is underway, you'll be for about 10 days, nothing will be happening. So, hey, what you need to be doing in that time is you need to be getting your homeowner's insurance quoted. You need to make sure you've tied down what attorney you're going to use because we need to order your title work. You need to maybe start getting ready for your move, you know, lining up a truck to move with, get your utilities changed over. There's a lot of things you can be doing in those 10 days, 7 to 10 days that we're waiting for an underwriting response. When the underwriter responds, Carrie, how do they usually respond? What do we get back from them?
We get what's known as a conditional approval.
Okay, conditional. That sounds fishy. So what does that mean, conditional?
It means we will approve your loan as long as you provide XYZ.
And the XYZ is usually what? Page 7 was
right,
blank.
Page 7 that was missing.
Right, yeah.
verification of your earnest money deposit that you put in when you sign the contract.
Usually they're technicalities, don't you think? When we get a conditional approval, it's not like, okay, you're in limbo. It means, all right, this all looks great. We're going to approve the loan.
Sure.
But we got to kind of zip up some of the loose ends here and get some more clarification on a few documents before we give a final approval. And once the loan is approved with conditions, we have to ask you to provide those conditions. And your response time is a big dictator as to whether we are going to close on time. So promptness and thoroughness, all of those things you be prepared for because you can help your loan close faster by just being prompt and being thorough. We will have ordered title work in the meantime. Sometimes title work comes back with a problem. We need some time to fix the title problems. Most title problems can be fixed. But I would say that's fairly small, but maybe 5 to 10% of all transactions, we got a title issue to take care of. Appraisal issues, those are probably more. What kind of appraisal issues do we have, Carrie?
Sometimes the value comes in lower than expected.
Sometimes need a renegotiation,
yeah.
What else?
Sometimes there's something that needs to be repaired in the house.
Exactly, and repairs have to be done before you can close your loan. So effectively, after you bring us your conditions, we have the appraisal. There's no issues on the appraisal. We have the title work. There's no issues on the title. Once all of that has been reviewed by the underwriter, then the underwriter will issue what is known a clear to close, or in our lingo, a CTC, cleared to close. And then we're just ready to close, Carrie, right? Next day, next hour.
Not quite.
Yeah, we
almost.
Wish. Okay, we used to could, but we can't anymore. So what do we have to do from there?
There's a mandatory 3-day waiting period.
And what do they have to get before that 3-day waiting period begins?
They have to get their closing disclosure. It's
a CD. That's
right.
Not your CD-ROM. That's your closing disclosure.
So that's like a more final version of the loan estimate. It looks very similar.
And, Carrie, when they design a CD, it's supposed to be the final numbers, but it really isn't.
It's really not. Yeah, typically the lender will send it out, and then they'll collaborate with the attorney. So while the numbers are going to be fairly close, they are not final yet.
However, on the CD, again, the fees can't change. Any cures in fees have to be done at that point by the broker or the lender. The only thing that can change are variable items like property tax prorations and insurance premiums and stuff like that.
And
right?
Sometimes it's, you know, some of the title fees may not be 100% accurate, some recording fees, but the broker-related fees can't change.
And after you get your CD and you have electronically acknowledged it, you have to wait 3 days and then you can close, right? So let's talk about what to bring to closing. What are you going to bring to closing, Carrie?
Well, you.
You.
Your ID.
Your ID.
Your spouse, if they're on the loan or on title.
Important. Or even if they're not on the loan, but they're on the title.
Right.
Bring your spouse. A hand brace for your sore hand after you finish signing 100 closing documents. Right? And what do you not want to bring to closing?
Well, you may not want to bring your kids.
Your rowdy kids.
Your impatience.
Yeah. And probably not the family dog.
Not the dog. Yeah.
All right. Thanks for joining us, folks. Hope you're educated. Call us if we can help.